talk a little bit about the Venezuela Embassy Protective Collective. About Venezuela, what you're seeing here are slides from the Venezuelan Embassy Protection Collective.
From inside the embassy?
That's inside the embassy. This is outside people, this guy's from Germany. I wasn't going to refer to the pictures, they're just going to continuously feed. It's about 107 pictures about, in kind of chronological order, about what happened there. This is inside the embassy. That's a conference room where we all work during the day. But before getting to the collective, I put a little background about Venezuela and why we did this, and then happy to answer your questions. So I was in Venezuela twice in the last year or so. The first visit was for the May 2018 presidential election. And even though we call Maduro a dictator, there was actually an election. People went to precincts and voted. I visited a bunch of precincts. There were more than 300 election observers, and they all unanimously concluded it was an election that was legitimate under international law as far as what's required for a democratic election, that there was no fraud and that Maduro was legitimately elected. And that's recognized by the United Nations. That's recognized by 150 countries. And I'll get into the U.S. coup attempt and how that's failed. But before getting into that, let me go back to a little more history. Venezuela had been essentially under the control of the United States for the last century. 1920s, Venezuela discovered oil. It was the largest producer of oil up to the 1960s when OPEC developed. It still has the largest oil reserves in the world. It also has the largest diamond and gold reserves. It also has the fifth largest gas reserves, and it also has precious minerals necessary for electronics and for weapons. I think that latter category is the real issue for the United States, because we're dependent on China and parts of Africa that China controls for those kinds of minerals. And so that's essential, really, for our weapons industry and our empire. And so in 1998, Hugo Chavez was elected, and that was a shocking breakthrough, because that was essentially a declaration of independence from the United States. And the United States does not like countries that declare their independence. All the countries on our target list, the U.S. target list, from Cuba to Iran to Syria, these are all countries that have said no to U.S. empire. Our first CIA coup attempt, a couple years after the CIA was created, was 1949 in Syria. It was a failed attempt, but it did end a democracy, and a military dictatorship followed in Syria. So in Venezuela, Chavez was elected, new constitution is written, voted on by the people, and a whole new era. They added a star to the Venezuelan flag as a new era began. One of the differences between the Chavistas, the Chavez supporters, and the people who ended up surrounding this embassy, the people who oppose Chavez have a 7-star flag. The Chavez Venezuelans have an 8-star flag. So that's one of the differences you can see between the coup supporters and the Chavez supporters. And in 2002, there was a coup attempt against Chavez. He was actually removed from office for 48 hours. The head of the Chamber of Commerce took over as president. His first act was to say, Constitution's out, even though it had been voted in by the people. And in 48 hours, the people overwhelmed the coup government, and Chavez was brought back to power. And I think Chavez got even more radical after that. He became a people's president and more radical reforms. And it's really interesting. We were in Venezuela the most recently in March. We went to a barrio of 1.5 million people, a poor community, one of the poorest in Caracas. And before Chavez was elected, this whole community was not even on the map because it got no services. Didn't exist as far as the government was concerned. Now you go to that community and there's mass transit, there's health centers, there's dental clinics, there's urban gardens, there's food on the corners. You know, you can buy vibrant communities. It's so interesting to see. And this was never on the map before. Poverty before Chavez was 76%. And now it's down to single digits. And even with this economic war that the U.S. is fighting now, with these illegal unilateral coercive measures, which are what sanctions are, even with this economic war, they are building social housing for the poorest. They've built over 2 million social housing units. Their population is 30 million people. 2 million housing units, 4 people per unit, that's 832 people.
2.8 million.
Now it keeps on growing, that's right. keeps on growing. And so you're talking about like 10 million people getting housed in social housing. We looked for homeless in Venezuela and couldn't find them. We actually looked. We looked under bridges. We went out in the middle of the night searching for it. We couldn't because they have this amazing social housing. You think about 10 million people out of a population of 30 million in the United States with our population of 300 million, that'd be a massive housing program. In the United States, of course, we see homeless everywhere. I mean, I live in Baltimore. You can't drive through downtown Baltimore without seeing homeless people. It's just horrendously embarrassing. It's not a perfect society at all. In fact, it's very much a capitalist society still. 70% of their economy is capitalist. People on the left, actually, in Venezuela, complain that Maduro is going too slow in putting in place a socialist state. They'd like to see a more rapid advancement. And Chavista side says, we call it the Bolivarian process because it's a gradual process. We're trying to put this in place democratically. They're not trying to like come in and say, we're taking control of all the industry. They're trying to bring the community together to create a democratic process toward socialism. And as far as democracy goes, which is really important about Venezuela, they are hyper-democratic. You know, we call them a dictatorship, but it's exact opposite. And that's what you find when you go to countries that under U.S. attack is that we're told the opposite of the truth. It's not just a graying of the truth, it's a black and white difference. And as far as democracy goes, as for the election, it is an incredibly run election. Jimmy Carter, when he looked at them when he was about 10 years ago, when he was younger, he actually went and looked at, was an election monitor, and said it was the best election system in the world. That's still true today. I've worked on election integrity in the United States, where we have these electronic voting machines, many without any paper record. They have electronic voting machines with a paper record, and they start their vote with a fingerprint. You have to go in with a fingerprint. That starts the process. You end with a fingerprint. So that's impossible to have fraud at that stage. There's no way to have fraud. And when you vote, you have an electronic vote, and you get a paper ballot. You look at the paper ballot. You put it in the ballot box. And one thing they do that no other country does is at the end of the election, on election day, they do a random audit of 54% of the machines in every precinct. Random audit. And what they call it a citizens audit because it's observed by the public. All parties are invited. The media is able to cover it. It's videotaped. They take, for the randomly audited machines, they take the bad paper ballot out, they read it, and they show it to everybody. And they count it. And if the count is consistent with electronic vote, then that machine's good and that precinct's good. They use electronic votes for that precinct. If not, they count every ballot by hand. So we fight audits in this country. We even have machines that can't do audits. These paperless machines can't do audits because if the software is making a mistake and you want to recount, you press the same button and the software makes the same mistake. It's not going to change. You have to have an alternative source to measure, and so the voter-verified paper ballot is the key. And that's just one of many things. Just that process is one of many things. The other thing about Venezuela is, well, two things. One, the National Electoral Commission is actually a separate branch of government. They have five branches of government. We have three. They have five branches of government. And the Electoral Commission is a separate branch of government. They are appointed by a majority of the assembly, and the commissioners then pick the chairperson. It's actually a woman. Some people assume Maduro is the one who's running the elections. No, it's a separate branch of government. And the other thing is that they have in their constitution a right to vote. We don't have a right to vote in our constitution. When you have a right to vote, that changes everything because then the government has a responsibility to help you exercise that right. You have a right to it, you have to be able to exercise it. And so they went from like 70% registered voters 10 years ago to like 95% now and trying to get to 100% registered. They're actually, the government's taking responsibility for registering voters. They actually go out and register people. They're trying to get 100%. So we are, you know, unregistering people, they're registering people. It's the opposite, very hyper-democratic. And the other really major thing about their democracy is that it's not just based on a representative democracy. They want to move toward a direct participatory democracy where the people actually make decisions. And they're doing that from the bottom up. If 200 households come together and form an assembly, it's a recognized community council that can hold general assembly meetings and make decisions for their community. And then they go to the government. We want more housing here. We want this daycare center, we want this urban garden, and they get the resources to put in place that program. These community councils actually make changes in their communities. And then these community councils can come together with other community councils and form a commune. Two representatives from each council go to this commune, and they make decisions for a wider area. And the same thing happens. They go to the government and get the resources to make it happen. So the goal for Venezuela, again, this is a process, is to replace representative democracy with direct democracy. That's the long term. That's a major effort, and that's what they're working toward. So when I say it's a hyper-democracy, it's not just its representative, but all the way down. And the one other point I think of democracy is that we hear a lot about this Citizens' Assembly, National Constituent Assembly, which is in addition to the National Assembly, there's a National Constituent Assembly that is the most powerful body in the Constitution, more powerful than Maduro. It's often a temporary assembly that can rewrite the Constitution and do other temporary things. But some interesting things about that are, in addition to the representative democracy that is based on geography, they also have representatives for specific groups. For example, there's Afro-Venezuelan seats, and people vote for Afro-Venezuelan seats. So there's an Afro-Venezuelan representative in the Constituent Assembly. Same with labor union workers, and same with disabled Venezuelans. They have special seats for various categories that are that way because they want to make sure that those groups are covered in the assembly and part of the discussion, not just the geographic representation, where maybe the disabled wouldn't get represented, but would move on. So we saw this in action. We were in Venezuela. All this kind of stuff we saw really exists. And when we were in Venezuela, we saw that the people of Venezuela are so politically aware. They are aware about U.S. imperialism. They know the history of the United States, and they are deeply educated politically. They have weekly mass marches that are the size of the marches we saw during the Bush-era Iraq War protests and the size of the women's march we saw that the Democrats organized in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration. We were in the middle of a march. We couldn't see the beginning and end. It was just hundreds of thousands of people. And they were so happy to see us there, Venezuelans, that we were from the United States. They were so happy to see us there, because they know that we're being lied to here, and they want us to come back home and tell the truth, because they really know that things are being misrepresented, and they're totally correct about that. And so during that process, we really got to know Venezuelans at various levels, from the grassroots, the popular movements, leftist groups, government, at various levels of government, up to Maduro and the foreign minister. It was an incredible experience, and we developed relationships at all those levels. And so when we started to hear about the coup failed in Venezuela, and the United States was trying to externalize the coup. They were giving the coup plotters Venezuelan properties. They gave them UN offices, UN missions were given to the coup plotters in New York. They gave them military attaché buildings in Washington, D.C. And we heard they were going to do the crown jewel, which is this embassy, which is a massive embassy. Five-floor building, two levels of garages in Georgetown, very wealthy community. 80 people worked there. And it was just a big building. And when the OAS, the Organization of American States, recognized Guaido as the president, they kicked the Venezuelan ambassadors out. They gave them 2 weeks. And that OAS vote was interesting because they couldn't get the required two-thirds vote that's needed to recognize a new government. So they changed the rules and made it a majority vote. They voted, barely got a majority, and voted Guaido as the president. And then they gave the Venezuelan ambassadors to the OAS 2 weeks to leave. Normally you get 2 months to leave. They gave them 2 weeks. We went to the Venezuelan embassy that day and talked to the people in the embassy, offered to be there to protect the embassy, to serve as protectors, interim protectors, to try to uphold international law and prevent the embassy from being violated. They thought about it. We talked about it, and they decided to allow us to do that. They asked, do you really think you can stop this embassy from being taken? We said, we don't know. I've been involved in lots of movements. I started out in 1980 when I was in law school working on legal marijuana and ending the drug war, harm reduction, needle exchange, those kinds of issues. I worked on Occupy, helped to organize Occupy when the Occupy movement was beginning. We organized that for months before Occupy Wall Street began. And you never know what's going to happen with these things. And I explained to the embassy that we don't know what the opposition is going to do. We don't know what the government is going to do. We don't know what our allies are going to do. Will people show up with us? We didn't know any of these possibilities. And so how the media is going to react, none of that was known. And so we said, all we can do is step in and try. We think there's a better chance to stop it before it happens than after it happens. And so they said, okay, you're welcome to do it. Here's the key. And we went in, and for the first few weeks, it was fantastic. Before the siege began, we could go in and out of the embassy with no problem. We could bring food into the refrigerator, cook our own meals. People go out to restaurants if they want to. We had forums every night where people would come in to hear about Honduras or about Nicaragua or about AFRICOM. We had 100 people coming in every night to various forums or cultural events. We had musical events, cultural events of all sorts. We have art builds, where families came in and built art, some of these signs that you see in these pictures, telling our story. And what was great about these forums was when you did forums on Honduras or Nicaragua or Cuba.
Is that Vanessa?
That's Vanessa Beck, yes.
She's from Chicago.
And she's a single payer activist. That's who you're talking about. She works with us on single payer still, as well as other issues. And so by having these different networks in, word was getting out we were doing this. And so when the siege came, all these networks knew we existed already. We had all that social media developing with those connections. That was really key because that's one of the forums you can see with kind of how many people were showing up to hear these things. We did one amazing forum. The night before we thought that the government would come in to take us out because the ambassadors were leaving, we had a forum with John Kiriakou, a former CIA agent, and he did a forum on regime change from inside the CIA. And told things that were shocking, that the Congress doesn't even know about. There is actually a regime change office in the CIA where they are targeting a country, they develop a plan, then they bring that plan to that office, the office sends it to the Department of Justice, office sends it to the White House National Security Council, and they review it and come back with a yes or no. And he told stories about some of the coups that were planned that way and the money that they received to do them. And he remembers, I can't remember what country it was, one coup that was planned, and it came back with the approval, and he said, wow, I can't believe they approved that, the superior said. So there's a regime change office that actually is planning coups regularly in the CIA. Is that amazing? It's just incredible to me. So that's us all working there at the embassy. People stayed. We had up to 70 people sleeping there at night. People stayed and worked during the day. And we had visitors coming constantly, so it was all really easy and smooth for the first few weeks. Then it came to, we came in on April 9th was the OAS vote. April 10th we came in. We stayed for 37 days. On April 30th, there was a coup attempt in Caracas. This is about the third try of a coup attempt by Juan Guaido. He's failed and failed and failed, and he failed that day as well. But we got a call from Caracas that day saying, there's a coup attempt happening. We didn't think we can handle it here, but you should expect protesters to come to the embassy. And that was the day that actually Amy Goodman was there interviewing us. And so we did the old interview, and as she was finishing the interview, we were walking outside, and we started seeing these opposition people showing up. And it was like, what's going on? And that was the beginning of the siege. And it was really a siege. That first day, we were in the front of the building at the vestibule as the front, and they were trying to get to the front door. We were there blocking them from coming up the steps. Gradually, more police came. Became a conflict between the coup supporters and the protectors. And the police put up bike racks to divide us. We were out there all day through the night trying to prevent them from getting to the embassy. The next day, more people came, and it became a siege. We were three sides of the building were surrounded by pro-coup people. These are not all Venezuelans. They were people from many countries that have had leftist governments, Cubans, Nicaraguans, El Salvador. I mean, a number of countries where left governments have come in and people who were in the wealth class have fled. And that's who was out front. And some reporters actually did analysis of some of the people. They were people with security clearances, with the military-industrial complex, with large PR firms, lobby groups. These were not grassroots people. These were people who would profit from a coup. And so they surrounded us, and their job was to terrorize us. Because under the Vienna Convention, which is a convention that protects embassies, the host government is required to protect the embassy. And the embassy is inviolate. What that means is that even the U.S. government cannot go into that embassy without the protection, without the permission of the Venezuelan government. And that protects embassies around the world. Required for all embassies in the United States, and that prevented the police from coming in. And so they allied with this pro-coup mob to block food from getting in, block people from getting in, and if our allies tried to provide food, they'd be assaulted by this mob, and the people who were assaulted became were arrested. They were the victims, not the assault people doing the assaults when they weren't arrested, but our allies were. And so they were blocking food from coming in. They were doing all sorts of noise and lights and threats. They were doing all sorts of racist things to our black allies, doing ape images and banana images, doing threatening sexual assault to our female allies. You know, all sorts of threats of violence were going on by these pro-coup people. And they just were there surrounding the embassy, and the Secret Service was working with them. Secret Service is responsible for protecting embassies. And they would be banging on doors. They'd be coming. There were several times they actually broke doors. They took a sledgehammer to a door in the garage, broke the handle off so you couldn't lock that door. We had to barricade that door with boards and doors that we found in the embassy and push a car against it to barricade that door, which they could still get through. We had a number of challenges with that. They actually broke into the embassy. One guy broke in, came up to the third floor and barricaded himself in an office. We had to get permission from the foreign minister to allow a limited waiver of inviolability to allow the police to come in to get him and take him out. There was another person who broke in windows, and he was about to let a whole lot of folks into the embassy in the door. And Margaret Flowers, my partner, ran, it was the middle of the night, happened to woken up, intruder. She ran down. She confronted him. During the confrontation, she saw that the back door was partially open. She grabbed the door handle and put her foot up against to pull it, and people on the outside were pulling to get in. So the plan was this guy's going to let a whole bunch of people in. And Margaret, by herself, stopped that from happening. An amazing moment in this fight against the coup. Just crazy stuff. And so as this developed, it became more and more evident that we were staying, and we, as I said, we had a peak of 70 people in there, but because food was cut off and because people had health issues, family issues, job issues, school issues, we gradually shrunk down to about 20 or so. And then when the food stopped, we started to talk about what's the strategic goal here? How do we stay here longer? And so we reduced our size to about 13. Three were embedded journalists, and then others, and then they shut off the power, so we had no electricity, and that meant no water because the water pumps didn't work, so no power, no water. And then we decided to shrink further. We shrank down to 7. And then one night we got told the police were coming to arrest us. We had a long negotiation with our lawyers and the police on where. We agreed that would be in the front door. And we did our live stream with our embedded journalists explaining this was the moment they're coming to arrest us. And the three embedded journalists left because they didn't want to risk arrest. The final four of us stayed. The police broke the locks on the front door, chain cutter, the locks that were put there by the embassy staff, and they came to the front door. We were inside in the vestibule waiting for them. They had a notice of eviction. They had plastered it on the building, but it was not facing inward. It was facing out. We couldn't read it, but they gave us a piece of paper, 11 by a piece of paper, no letterhead, no signature. We don't know where it came from, and said that Carlos Vecchio says you have to leave. You're evicted. Carlos Vecchio is the fake ambassador. He's not really an ambassador. He's a former oil executive who is now being investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice for embezzling tens of millions of dollars from Citgo. But he's the fake ambassador. He is ordering us to leave. We said, who's Carlos Vecchio? He's nobody. We're here with the permission of the Venezuelan government. So we then had a standoff at the front door with the police. This is about 8 o'clock at night. It's dark out. There's a massive crowd of both pro-coup and pro-peace crowds. The police divided the crowds. The pro-coup crowds were like so excited we're getting arrested. They're doing high fives. They're like cheering. They're finally we're getting arrested. We're going to get taken out of the embassy. And of course, the peace crowd was there cheering us on. And so it was this very dramatic moment. The police come into the vestibule. We have a conversation with them, about a 45-minute face-off where we explain the Vienna Convention and what it means. And why it's important. We explained to the police that if they cross that vestibule, they're violating international law. We're not violating the law. We're here legally. We have a key to get in and out. We didn't have to cut the locks on the door. We have a key to get into the other doors. You would be the one breaking the law. And if you break this law, that means the Vienna Convention is disappearing. And if a year from now, if you hear of a U.S. embassy that is under attack, or where embassy personnel are injured, or embassies taken over, think back to this moment, because it's you who violated the Vienna Convention and replaced the rule of law with the rule of the jungle. We told them that you should turn around, go back to your superiors and discuss this, because it's a major international event. We kept talking. We described how that there's a conflict between the U.S. and Venezuela right now, how Russia and China are allied with Venezuela, how Colombia and Brazil on the borders of Venezuela are allied with the United States, and this is a potentially big military conflict, and that we're trying to demilitarize and de-escalate. We're serving as interim embassy protectors, and that we are willing to leave voluntarily once there is a mutual protecting power agreement between the U.S. and D.C. And Venezuela. They were negotiating that agreement right then because Switzerland was going to become the protector for the U.S. embassy in Caracas. This is a very common thing, protecting power agreements. When there's a break in diplomatic relations, a third country becomes the protector. It's been going on for hundreds of years. There are currently 20 protecting power agreements that the U.S. is involved in right now for countries around the world. And so we were saying when you have a mutual protecting of power agreement that's being negotiated right now with Switzerland protecting the U.S. embassy and Turkey protecting this embassy, both Switzerland and Turkey had agreed. We just need Venezuela and the U.S. to agree. Venezuela's agreed. We just need the U.S. to agree. So it's getting down to the final moment where we can have a protecting power agreement and we can leave voluntarily. And so we're here to try to de-escalate by serving as protectors, upholding international law, and protecting the violation of this embassy. And we explained that if you come into this embassy, because of the conflict that exists, you could be creating a military, you're escalating. And that could be a result in a military conflict between Colombia, Brazil, and the U.S. against Venezuela, China, and Russia. And so if you come into this embassy and escalate the situation, you can tell your grandchildren you violated international law and started a global conflict. And that's what would have happened. And so we said, please, go back and talk to your superiors. Step back and think about this. And so they decided to step back. They walked to their car, one of them did, the guy we were talking to, and another cop stepped up. We talked to him for a while. The other guy came back and said, we're going to leave. We were like, whoa, that's shocking. We thought we were going to be arrested. We didn't say that, but that's what we were thinking. We're going to leave, and we're going to lock the door with these plastic cuffs, and we're going to leave, and if you knock on the door, the cops will open the door, and you can leave. We said, thanks, goodbye, and they left, and we went to the second floor, and our crowd went wild. Their crowd was dejected, and it was like a major turnaround. We thought we were going to be arrested that night. Instead, it was turned around into a major victory. And then the next day, Jesse Jackson showed up. And Jesse Jackson showed up. He's 80 years old. He has Parkinson's disease. He's struggling. He's very much wants to see a peace movement in the United States. He talked about that multiple times with us. Afterwards, we had lunch with him when we got out. He really wants to help build a peace movement. But he came out. He had a very hard time talking, so we did a mic check. Occupy mic check. He'd say something and our crowd would repeat it. After he did that and did his press event, he was given 3 bags of food. He walked over to the embassy and we tried to get that food up into the embassy. One of the ways we did that was there's Jesse right there. Taking this. There's a fight. You see, Jamu Baraka was the Green Party vice presidential candidate and they were fighting on the ground with the pro-coup people because one of them wrapped the rope around his arm. We had a bag with a rope on it that we would fill up with food and pull to the second floor. He wrapped his arm around. There's a big fight on the ground. The police didn't know what to do because Jesse Jackson's there, so they let the fight go on. Our side finally won the fight. We got 3 bags of food up, and we had produce for the first time in a long time. We had gone through produce because we didn't want that to rot. We had no refrigeration. We didn't want that to rot, so we got the produce first. So it was great to get real produce. We had a banana, which was fantastic. And we just were just like so ecstatic that we were still there, and now we had food. I think that's when the government realized they had to act, because Jesse Jackson coming kind of the dam starting to burst. And that meant that more people would come. Maybe Tulsi Gabbard would come. Maybe Mike Gravel would come. Maybe celebrities would come. You know, who knows what would happen. And so media came that day. And there had been a media blackout, except for our social media. There had been a media blackout of this amazing event, this unique event in history, where people in the United States went to an embassy to protect it from a U.S. coup. Never happened before. And I don't think they don't want it to happen again. And so the police decided they have to come in. So the next day, we get a phone call. Luckily, my phone was charged. We had been charging our phones in the garage on cars because we had no electricity. So we had our phones at about 15% charge. While we were charging the phones, by the way, we'd use the heat of the car to cook. So we'd actually be cooking on the car as well while we're charging our phones. We had no electricity. And so we had to use the car to heat things up. We also had a solar oven on the roof. And we also discovered that you can cook food without heat, like pasta. You could put it in water, and if you wait long enough, it becomes soft enough to eat. It doesn't work with rice, but it worked with pasta. It doesn't work with all kinds of beans. It worked with some kind of beans, so we had to learn these things. We had some fantastic tacos with tuna fish, opened the can and had a fish taco. It was fantastic. So we had all sorts of great recipes, and even though we were eating very small amounts, we were eating a little bit. We had a big food supply that we had been restoring and being careful about and lowering our calorie intake. We'd also reserved a lot of water. We filled every bucket with every trash can with lined with plastic bags and filled them with water. It's just like, we were really trying to stay a long time. And we explained to the police when they came to that door that night that we were willing to stay without eating. We were prepared to fast. We were prepared to carry on a stretcher if we were ill. We're not going to give up. So they knew we were there seriously. This is, by the way, a rally in Caracas. They were doing a solidarity rally telling us we're heroes. And so we're surrounded by these pro-coup people. And in Caracas, they're doing, Adrian, you're a hero. Margaret, you are a hero. It was like, wow, it's like so weird. And so the police decided to come and get us. We got a phone call that morning about 8:30 after breakfast. Luckily, my phone was on. It wasn't always on. Luckily, it was on. And they said, we got an arrest warrant. We're coming in. If you don't come out now, we're coming in. They had battering ram with the back door. They didn't cut the locks on the plastic handcuffs on the front door. They came with more than 100 police, 5 different police agencies, many police in military gear with military weapons, did a battering ram in the back door. The whole building was shaking. We had sent them an email saying that we would not resist if they came in. We're not going to voluntarily go because we're here legally. But if you come in, we're not going to resist. We're not going to hide. We're not going to, put up barricades inside. We'll wait for you in the second floor conference room. We told them that. And so they were barricading and, hitting the front back door, and they finally got in. They came up and got us. We were in a conference room, the final four of us, with 17 police. They handcuffed us. Margaret's giving them a lecture while Margaret Flowers is giving them a lecture while they're doing it. They take us downstairs. There's no electricity, so the building, the stairways are all dark. The garage is all dark. But there's glow sticks everywhere. They came in. They threw glow sticks all over the place, like it began a rave. It's a very, very strange situation in the garage. All these glow sticks on the floor. It was really interesting. And they take us out, and they could have taken us to the magistrate that day. It was 9:00 in the morning by then. Magistrate meets at 1:30. They could have taken us to the magistrate, but they decided not to. They decided instead to take their time. We got held at a precinct for a few hours, then we got held overnight in central booking. We had 2 men and 2 women, so one in the women's section, one in the men's section, one group in each section, and made sure we had an uncomfortable night. And we went out. We got charged with this strange offense of interfering with protective function. We weren't charged with trespass or breaking and entering or unlawful entry, anything like that, but interfering with protective function. We've since found that it's never been used before for protecting a building. It's been used in situations where an ambassador or some official is being protected and someone interferes with that. This is the first time it's been used for charging someone in the building. It's a 1-year potential of criminal offense with up to a $100,000 fine each. The plea bargain that's been offered has been plead guilty and let the judge sentence you. Plus, we're going to charge you for the police time, and we're going to charge you for any damage to the embassy. So it's not a very friendly plea bargain, and we, of course, didn't accept. We're not looking for a plea bargain. We have the right to a jury trial. We have very strong arguments on our side. We plan to take this as far as we can take it. Luckily, there's a group that's formed, a committee has formed, to the Embassy Protectors Committee, and they are raising people's awareness, and we're doing these tours to raise people's consciousness and awareness. We're raising money. We've raised about $32,000, maybe $33,000 so far. We're trying to raise $60,000. For our legal costs, and we're in that process now, and I just finished a 7-stop tour in California. We're doing 5 stops in Illinois, 3 stops in Florida. We have a Northeast tour, a New York tour, New Jersey tour, so we're really working hard to put together a strong defense. We have an excellent defense team. The government's not making it easy. They're fighting us every step of the way on every little issue. They're giving us all sorts of nonsensical discovery, useless 800 police body cam videos. 800? How do you go through 800 police body cam videos? And when we said we can't do 800, they said, the judge ordered them to say, which ones are you going to do? And they came up with a list of 30. Unfortunately, their list of 30 that they're going to use didn't match the list of 800. So you couldn't figure out from the 30 which ones they were going to cover. So then we had to pay, you know, expensive technicians to figure that out, to try to figure these things out. So it's a very complicated and expensive process they're trying to put us through. But we think with a jury trial and with the issues we have an opportunity to actually win. Whether it's a dismissal or whether it's an acquittal, a jury coming out and saying no to this prosecution is a major victory. It's a real slap in the face, another slap in the face to the Venezuelan coup by the U.S. And so we hope to use this case to raise consciousness, get people active, and put on a strong defense and help to stop the coup. So if anyone has any questions, yes, I'm back. The question is when it's supposed to come to trial, and that we don't really know the answer to yet. That's a big fight. We have right now pending a discovery request, which is, I think, a very important discovery request. We're asking, what the issue comes down to is who's in control of the embassy. Is it the fake Trump coup, so-called government, and Carlos Vecchio, the former oil executive, or is it the elected government? And, you know, the Trump administration says they don't recognize Maduro, they recognize Guaido. But we know that Trump and Maduro's governments are negotiating on various issues, like protecting the embassy in Caracas, the U.S. embassy in Caracas, as one example. And so we're asking, one of the discovery requests is any contacts between the Maduro government and the Trump government, because that will show that they actually realize that Trump is, that Maduro is the president. And in fact, Elliot Abrams, when he was asked about why there had not been an election, because under the Constitution, when you have an interim president, you have 60 days and then there's an election. That hadn't happened after 60 days. And so they asked Abrams why. He said, because Maduro is still in power. Well, if Maduro is still in power, then why is Carlos Vecchio telling us to leave? And so that's a key issue. And it's a key issue because it also is relative to our intent. If we are, and as we said to the government over and over, we're there legally, we're there with permission of the government, we're not violating any trespass or unlawful entry, we're here as interim protectors. The government knows it. That's our mens rea, our intent as far as criminally goes. We were there legally. And so that's the, and so as far as we have to fight that battle first, and that will determine the trial schedule. It could happen as early as February. It could happen as late as next fall. There's a lot that are unpredictable in this process. So we're preparing for a long-haul battle, but that's where it stands.
Either four defendants?
Four defendants.
Okay. And you mentioned that you were an attorney. Are you part of the legal team?
No, we have four defendants. Right now we have four lawyers, but that may change. And one of us may go pro se and represent herself. It won't be me. I have a lawyer. I used to practice law, and a partner who I practice with, John Zwirling, who's practiced law for criminal defense for 52 years, is an excellent lawyer, and he's my lawyer. And we have several other lawyers. And so we have a joint defense committee. Margaret's lawyer was recently, just yesterday, knocked out of the case because of scheduling conflicts. And so she has to either find another lawyer, but she's thinking about going pro se, which is represent herself. So that's in discussion right now. But right now we have three lawyers, maybe four, and a joint defense committee.
And are they pro bono?
Low bono. One of the lawyers, normally, who's a great lawyer. He was a former public defender who trained public defenders in that court, in the federal district court in Washington, D.C. He's now a lawyer for corporate criminals, and he charges $700 an hour. He's not charging us that, but but he's a great lawyer. And John Zwirling is also, very experienced, excellent lawyer. So we're charging us low bono, but there are other expenses as well. Like I mentioned, the technician expenses as one example, just dealing with those body cam videos. So it's an expensive process. And, of course, the U.S. government has unlimited resources. We're really pleased that a committee is formed to help us. In fact, these cards here I'll pass around. These are from our defense committee. You can have one, too, before you leave. These are cards about you pick one and pass it back. And those are about how, if you want to get involved in this, you can go to that website, defendembassyprotectors.org, and you can either donate or just get aware, get involved. You know, we're in the process of trying to do all this. Yes, I'll get you next.
Present this case that he somehow stole the election, just like they did last year with Maduro.
I'll just repeat that for the tape, but yes, right now there's an ongoing conflict in Bolivia. Evo Morales was just reelected in the first round of the election. There was going to be a second round. If he didn't win by 10%, he would have been a second round. He barely won by 10%, and so there will not be a second round. And the opposition has essentially rioted, burned buildings, burned the electoral buildings, and it's quite it's an incredible scene. And you're right about how they try to delegitimize the Venezuelan election. They decide that months before the election occurred that the U.S. was not going to recognize it, and they tried to discourage people from running in the election. And they tried to, in the end, there were five candidates, one of them being Maduro, one being a former governor who was a neoliberal ally of the United States. And so there was a legitimate election. They tried then to discourage people from voting. At some of the precincts, there were actually people threatening those who came to vote to try to discourage voting, but they still had almost 50% turnout, which is low for Venezuela, but typical of the United States. And Maduro won 67% of the vote. The Bolivia case is very interesting and one to really watch. It would be of Evo Morales' fourth term. And that's the controversial part, because there was a referendum to allow him to have unlimited, or a president to have unlimited terms, that lost by a very small margin. Then the Supreme Court said that Bolivia, that he had the right to run because that law happened while he was still in office. And so he had the right to run, and he was allowed to run, and he won. Looks like he's won the election now. The interesting thing about this is the guy who came in second place was the former president before Morales. And he didn't finish his term because of protests. The protests were about the gas industry in Bolivia, which had been privatized, and the people wanted to be nationalized. And this former president made special deals with U.S. gas companies for low prices. And he was putting in place neoliberal policies. And so there were mass protests that drove him out of office. And he's the one that came in second place in this election. So it's a really interesting scene. I really am confident that Morales will handle it well and he'll be in office. But we're seeing these kind of color revolutions, and I'll talk about those in a second, in other parts of the world. Color revolutions, so-called color revolutions, from Hong Kong to Syria to Iran to Nicaragua. I mean, it's just incredible what we're seeing. So, yeah, Bolivia is a hot spot right now. Yes?
Thank you very much for taking up this struggle and the defense of the embassy and opposition to the U.S. in Venezuela. My question is, who's in the embassy now? Anybody?
Good question. What happened was, after we were taken out and then went through court and got out, the next day they opened the embassy to Carlos Vecchio. Vecchio went in, got a photo op showing he's in the window, I'm in the embassy. Then they kicked him out, and the embassy's been closed up. So they got the photo op to say they took it, but the embassy right now is inactive, and no one goes in and out of it. Any other?
Who's preventing them from going in and out?
Well, the United States government is actually has boarded up windows, and it's a boarded up building, and so the United States is not allowing anyone in or out. And Venezuela, the embassy staff, because of the sanctions, the unilateral economic coercive measures, because of those sanctions, they can't pay the staff. And so there's no embassy staff in the United States to do that. And so the embassy is just inactive at this stage. And I'll just say something about those unilateral coercive measures that we call sanctions. They're illegal under the UN Charter and international law. To try to coerce a government, a people to change their government, or a government to change their policy with economic war is not allowed under international law. And there are now about 36 countries that are facing U.S. sanctions, and multiple countries facing secondary sanctions. If you trade with Iran, if you trade with Venezuela, you can be sanctioned as well. And if, for example, in Venezuela, one of the programs they have is the CLAP program, which provides food to 6 million households every month. And that's 24 million people, four people per household. Out of 30 million population, 24 million people get the CLAP box, 15 cents a box, flour, pasta, sugar, cleaning materials, all sorts of stuff you need for the kitchen is included in the CLAP box. And what's the U.S. response? They're sanctioning the people who run the CLAP program. That's the U.S. response. And there's a growing, I will talk about this in the next section, about this growing movement we're developing that includes governments and civil society to form a woven network fighting for enforcement of international law. That means U.S. being stopped from putting in place illegal coercive measures unilaterally. Any one other question about Venezuela? The question was how many countries were represented at the embassy. And that's the second time I've gotten that question. We never actually counted that. I'd say my rough estimate is about 10 to 12. We particularly reached out to lots of countries. We had forums on Honduras and on Nicaragua. We had a whole forum on AFRICOM, which covered a number of countries. Zimbabwe is under sanctions. Other countries are as well. And so my guess is about 10 to 12 countries represented at the embassy at various times. Now the Venezuelans that we had didn't spend the night because they were afraid of being identified, because their families back home would be at risk. So they would come to events and not stick around. We did have Latin Americans in the embassy with us. We had African Americans, and so we had a good diverse crowd. Age-wise, we had from 17 years old. Well, actually, had kids at some point. Some parents brought their children for artworks and spending the nights at sometimes. But we had full-time there, kids in college and retired people in their 70s. And so it was a real range of people who stayed in the embassy. It was a really great diverse crowd. We do these as fundraisers, and you can donate online at the defendembassyprotectors.org, which is a great way to donate, or our fiscal agents, AFGJ, Alliance for Global Justice, AFGJ, so a check can be made to AFGJ. Anything else on the Embassy Protection Collective? Then we'll go on to the broader question. All right, thank you all very much.